I'm Dave Douglas. I'm a lifelong coal miner, political activist, trade union official, vegan, probably the only vegan coal miner in the world, supporter of the Republican movement in Scotland and in Ireland, Palestine solidarity, Vietnam solidarity, Chile solidarity. I'm in South Shields on Tyneside. I'm an eighth generation coal miner, and that's only because that's as far back as we could trace it. It may well go back further than that. My dad and my granddad both worked at Wardley Colliery, and I followed them into the mine after a brief attempt not to go to the pit. I actually started work. I left school when I was just before I was 15, as you did in them days. I tried working as a confectioner, and which was my mum's side of the family, and enjoyed that for a while. But they were all little sweatshops, and I was earning like £1.50 for 60 hours a week when you got a fiver at the pit for 37 hours. So, apart from the legacy and the tradition and the romance of coal mining, it was paid a lot better.
And it's a bit difficult to imagine it being romantic. It's pretty dirt, dark and dirty down there.
Oh, you're joking. In the 1960s, there were two prestigious things to be. One was an art student, and the other one was a coal miner. This was the age of revolution, remember? So the miners had a certain romantic attachment to them.
But I mean,
So
you're
I
trying
thought
to
a
tell me
double.
it wasn't dirty, it wasn't dark, it wasn't dangerous.
Yeah, of course it was. It was all of those things. But that was part of the adventure. It was different every day. It was an adventure every day. D.H. Lawrence said when he visited a coal mine, actually getting into the coal face was like climbing a small mountain every day. But the point is, people do climb mountains and they don't get paid for it. So.
So when you were down the mine in the 60s and 70s, what were conditions like?
Well, as I say, I worked in a. In one of the older mines, which was near the end of its life, so we were working very thin seams. We were working 18-inch seams. In order to actually get on the coal face, you had to get under what's called a cunch, which is the stone face of the rock, which hasn't been taken down yet to advance the tunnel, and that was about a foot high. I know that because I carried a miner's lamp every day, an oil lamp every day, part of my job. And I had to be very careful not to tilt it to get it under the height, because it would gun out, it would go out. So I know it was just over a foot high to get in, and then the working space was about 18 inches. We had a 2 foot seam as well, but and that was a jib cutter, so you cut a small slice of coal out down the whole face, which is maybe 180 yards long, and then the borer would come and bore holes all the way down the face. Shot fire would fire all the shots, and the men would crawl on and shovel the coal onto the rubber belts, conveyor belts, which ran behind them.
Now, when if you're talking about an 18-inch seam, that's not a lot. Is that would that be horizontal, vertical? And sometimes, because I know sometimes,
Horizontal.
you're looking at the strata of the earth.
Yeah.
The coal isn't necessarily just lying down horizontally on top of another bit. Sometimes it's slanted. But anyway, so and that doesn't sound like very wide, does it, David? It just sounds to me as if that mine maybe should have been closed years ago.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. In them days, we believed in real conservation, and you used the seam that you had. You didn't walk away from it and abandoned it. I mean, that was where the get rich quick plan of Thatcher came in, to try what she called marginal coal. It wasn't marginal coal at all. And we produced the cheapest deep mine coal in the world. The reason why she thought it was, I mean, some pits were less unprofitable or more profitable, depending how you look at it, than others. But we received the lowest subsidy anywhere in the world. We got £1.10 a tonne, when the Germans got £78 a ton, and the average was £58 a ton subsidy. We got £1.10, and but we still mined the cheapest coal in the world, the cheapest actual production coal in the 1980s. That is was Australian open cast coal with 200 odd foot seams on the surface, but they got a transport subsidy of £3.50 per ton. So we were operating at half of their actual sale costs, although they were cheaper than us in terms of production.
It doesn't sound to me as if there's any kind of real free market there at all.
Well, there wasn't, of course. It was a nationalised industry at first. It was nationalised in order to supply cheap energy to the country and to private capital. And we weren't allowed to reach the market price of the coal, otherwise the coal industry would have been even more super profitable. It was there to, I mean, in the 1960s when I started, there were 350,000 of us. You know, with families, we were talking nearly 2 million people, depending on, which was a large chunk of the population, and especially of the working population. And if you could control the vital resource such as coal, which was the primary form of energy production and also industrial production in terms of steel and manufacture and foundries and all of that stuff, then you held the market, the saleable price of whatever was produced using the coal.
What do you put the decline down to? I mean, you're talking there about 200, what is it? You say 200 foot seam. I mean, surely that's what you need to be digging out. And if they can do that in Australia, wasn't it inevitable that things were going to slowly be run down in Britain?
No. All of these things are questions of government policy. There's no inevitability in them. Why would it make more sense to have a man on the dole for the rest of his life rather than doing something productive like mining coal, which was essential to the country? When they tried to actually get rid of the coal industry, which they did after the end of World War II, and Wilson made his white hot heat of modern technology speech, saying that it was nuclear now. We needed to get these miners out of these dark caverns with water dripping on their back and working in thin seams, because now we had nuclear energy, because Wilson, like many people, thought uranium grew on trees. He didn't realize that in Namibia and South Africa, our colleagues working in the uranium mines had radioactive water dripping on their backs, working in desperate conditions, 10 times worse than coal miners did. You know, so but when they tried to phase down the industry and depend it on Arab oil, in much the way that running down British energy meant depending on gas imported from Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan and stable places like that, and Russia, of course the Arabs and the OPEC countries turned the oil off and left Britain with an energy crisis, and that was an opportune time for us to go on strike as well. But they realised that unless they wanted to be dependent on energy from abroad for everything that we do, the whole operation of the infrastructure of society and the economy, then you had to have your own source of energy. And we have abundant sources of coal somewhere in the region of 45 trillion tons of coal that's unmined.
Yeah, how long would that last, though, if it was being used?
45 trillion tons of coal, are you crazy? Yeah, probably about 2,000 years, 3,000 years.
So why, in your view, why have they decided that? I mean, I've just been reading recently about the Drax power station up in your neck of the woods somewhere, up north anyway. Yeah. Sorry to be such an ignorant southerner. But Drax used to be one of the biggest coal-fired power stations. It still has a reserve side of it, which can use coal. But now what they're doing is they are burning trees and what they call biomass in there, much of which is imported from the United States, which doesn't sound very green. But what they're saying is that they are using something called carbon capture, and therefore it's not being damaging the climate.
Well, that's all bollocks. I mean, the Greens campaigned to turn Drax off coal, which was the last consumer of the coal from Killinley pit, Hatfield main pit, which was my pit, and Thoresby in Nottingham. That was our sole market. We were supplying coal there at a price of £35 per tonne. It's currently imported at £285 per tonne, by the way. And the Greens lobbied and they got what they called biofuel, which was, of course, trees. So most of the trees that are burned in the world are burned in Drax. And apart from using valuable land, which should either be wild jungle land and woodland, it's taken up valuable areas where we could be growing food. So we're burning the burning wood, which is imported, turned into pellets, and imported in super tankers right across the world, put on trains, landed at Immingham and running into Drax through devastated pit villages with closed mines to burn in a power station, which is in our backyard. And it produces more CO2 than the coal that we burnt. Now, Drax already had a carbon capture system called the White Rose Scheme, not as good as the one at Hatfield, but nonetheless would have taken out 40% of emissions, CO2 emissions from the coal, which is in my backyard. And the government pulled the plug on it. And then because of the realization of the absolute nonsense of burning trees instead of coal, it's far more CO2, then they do take out a portion of the CO2 now, not more than 40%, because the CO2 from the trees is far more polluting than the coal is. So it's just a nonsense. It's in order to make sure that the National Union of Mine Workers didn't come back from the grave and haunt them, and to kill the last vestiges of the National Union of Mine Workers and everything it stood for in terms of the trade union movement and working class militancy.
So in this carbon capture system, can you just explain it a bit more? Because I think I understand it. The idea is that they want to pump the carbon dioxide under the ground and store it under the ground.
Yes, in disused oil wells, gas wells. The North Sea has enough capacity to take all of the CO2 emissions from Europe for about 500 years worth of production. The best scheme in the world was being developed at Hatfield Main, my colleague, by Richard Budge. Green energy, he called it. It was a power station years ahead of its time, which would have burnt the coal with no CO2 emissions at all, zero CO2 emissions. The government had a fund for the best carbon reduction scheme in the country, and it offered £1 billion. The cost of the whole project was going to cost £3 billion, and we'd already secured the avenues for the pipes to be conducted up the Humber and out to sea directly into disused gas and oil wells in the North Sea. The EU iron and steel community called it the best carbon reduction scheme in the world. The best carbon reduction scheme in the world, and they offered £1 billion scot-free, which was a third of the entire cost of the produce. Budge came up with match funding of £1 billion, and the government was supposed to put the other one in. The Chinese and the Indians said they didn't have the technology or the expertise to develop this technology, but they'd be happy to allow Budge and his company to build power stations like that in China and India. Had that been done, and it would take perhaps 5 years, you would have got rid of the entire CO2 atmospheric problem within 5 years. The government could see that this power station was going to produce the cheapest energy in Britain, bar none, the cheapest energy in Britain. And if people were allowed a real market choice, then they would use coal power and no other source, definitely not nuclear, which was £95 a tonne. And at that time, wind power was about 280 megawatt hour against about £35 for coal. So the government could see that the NUM was going to come riding back from the gates of hell and simply pull the plug on it and let it drop. You'll find this in my book, call climate change and the total destruction of the British mining industry. Have we not had that one?
Look, I mean, it's a bit rich to suggest that this whole thing has been done just because of the mine workers union, surely. I mean,
no,
the country needs power, doesn't it?
Well, that was the idea, but they thought the world was awash with cheap power, and that, you know, the gas, what happened was, in order to destroy coal's market, as I say, we supplied 80% of the market. In order to supply, to destroy coal's market, they had the dash for gas. Now, they built these absolutely unnecessary gas power stations and started consuming the gas, which left for domestic consumption and for specific key industries, would have lasted for 1,000 years at least. But they started burning it off in huge tracts. It's now about 40% of the grid. And it's our scarcest energy resource is gas, and we're burning it off. The sole purpose of doing that was to take away coal's market and close the coal mines. It had no other purpose whatsoever.
Completely different perspective. I'm sure some listeners will think, well, what's the point of all this CO2, shenanigans, the carbon capture and all that, because actually carbon dioxide doesn't really affect the climate very much at all, and there's an enormous amount of exaggeration. If you remember the climate gate leaks from Cambridge University, they do suggest that this is being exaggerated by a professional class of climate scientists who are paid by this industry basically to produce a climate scare. So what would you say to them?
Well, I mean, I have a lot in common with them, but I think it's irrelevant whether or not, I mean, I'm not a climate change cynic. I mean, climate change is hardwired into the planet and to space and to every planet in the universe. We wouldn't be here without it. The dinosaurs would still be roaming the planet. Climate change is, and you can't no more stop climate change than you can time or space. It's just part of existence. Now, whether CO2, man-made CO2, contributes to that, don't know. But I would suggest that given there are nearly 8 billion of us on the planet, we have to make an impact. Humanity obviously makes an impact on the environment. If all we did was piss and shit, then we'd have an impact on the environment. But we live here too. You know, contrary to the Greens' dogma, human beings are not alien to this planet. Everything we do is natural because it's part of us, our existence. So we have a right to be here. Now, obviously, aesthetically, I mean, the Earth doesn't have any preference for woodland and trees as opposed to concrete jungles and bloody skyscrapers. It's us who have the preference. We have an aesthetic preference, and part of our natural existence and evolution is in tune with nature and being part of nature. So we prefer trees and jungles and woodland and clean seas and stuff like that as part of our human existence. And we should minimize the damage that human beings do. The best way of minimizing the damage is through carbon capture and storage of coal. Coal production is rising throughout the world. It is now the greatest source of energy in the world. Now, if you look at any graph for the development of places like India or China or Indochina, then the rise in living standards is directly associated with the consumption of coal and the production of coal. Now, you can tell people, don't burn coal, don't develop your coal, and send them subsidies and leave Africa and other developing nations and the scrap. India has a fifth of all the coal in the world. Half of its population has no electricity. How dare anybody in the West tell those Indians who have no power, who rely on camel dung and anything they can find and a mud floor hut to make enough food for their family, that they can't have electricity, running water, sanitation, and all the other things that come with a fuel economy that's based on the coal that's on the doorstep. How dare they do that?
Well, look, what about that? Some people also say, it'd be interesting to get your take on this, that this is part of a sort of levelling effect. That really what's going on with the United Nations and their sustainable development goals is that they want the more backward countries, the developing world, to come up to the first world standards. And actually, of course, that might mean that we have to, in a way, kind of go back in time a little bit, almost like a sort of pre-industrial age, so that all countries around the world, and obviously Britain has done a lot of damage to the climate through all of its industry in the 18th and 19th centuries.
Well, look, you know, I mean, if you want to think that there's some golden age of agriculture in the Middle Ages, you know, when happy peasants were going along twigging a cow on the arse with a bloody twig, and we lived in mud huts, and we lived in adobe and wicker, then I can assure you humanity was not better off. And in any case, we ain't going back there. We've dragged ourselves out of that on the back of industry and on the back of productive capacity. The only way you can meet the needs of the population is by creating an abundance of wealth. 8 billion people in the world can't be hunter-gatherers living happily in the jungle, if they ever did live happily in the jungle. We need productive capacity in industry. And the fuel of industry at the moment is carbon. It's coal, power, oil and gas. Those are the keys to development. Now, contrary to what you're suggesting, keeping people in the dark ages are driving us back through time to some pre-industrial age in Britain. I mean, does anybody know anything about the history? That's going to help to raise the standards of life in the third world, in Africa, Asia, Latin America. Of course it isn't. It's the stimulation of industry, the creation of industry and energy, which allowed the third world countries to advance. Now, of course, there might be areas where indigenous people want to stay in the forest, want to live in the way they do, and good luck to them, that's fine. And we should certainly prohibit mining in areas where indigenous people and animals, it's an essential place for them to live. But we don't have to do that. There's enough resources in the world to avoid damaging what natural ecology we've got left in the world. But your average punter in Africa wants the same living standards and the same quality of life as people in the West have. That doesn't necessarily mean driving a big car. It doesn't necessarily mean having disproportionate wealth, but it does mean having sanitation, having electricity, having running water, having health and hygiene, having education, having roads, having communications, and all of the basic things we've taken for granted for the last 150, 200 years.
Well, look, let's have a look, for example, at the railways. After the Second World War, we were left with a very comprehensive system after having invented the thing, and universal steam power on the railways using coal. Then there was this wonderful thing that came along called diesel power, and in the early 1960s, all these steam trains were scrapped, melted down or whatever, and diesel came in. Do you think maybe that we may have to go back to using that sort of power? I'm getting a bit concerned because what with the rail strikes and the price of railways, actually, for example, if you want to go return to London from here on the train from Bristol, you're talking about £80. Oh. You want to go on a coach and use a little bit of fossil fuel in the coach, then it's going to cost you more like £8, so you know, a tenth to go by car or by coach or whatever than it is to, the train is becoming so ridiculously expensive. What do you make of the way that the railways have been run down, and also the fuel that they're using to drive them around? Because this used to be the way everyone went from, you know, if you were going around the country, you always went on a train, and also the network was much more comprehensive.
Yes, and you must remember that the Mallard and the Flying Scotsman were doing 100 miles an hour Edinburgh to London back in the 20s and 30s. But the truth of it was, we needed clean energy to power the railways, and that's electricity. So electrification of the railways was absolutely essential. As long as energy that's generated is dependable, and it can't be dependable if it's based on the bloody sun shining or the wind blowing. So you have to have a consistent base load.
Nuclear.
And the only means
nuclear.
Well, you can have nuclear. It's extremely expensive, but it's not a renewable, contrary to the green opinion, because it's based on uranium. There's probably about 90 years uranium left in the world. Most of the deep uranium mines in Russia and other places have now closed, and you're using basically smaller and smaller amounts of open cast uranium. But I mean, if you develop nuclear fission, which is sort of self-generating, then yes, you could have at some point in the future a renewable energy without the problem of the nuclear waste. Nuclear waste, as you know, it lasts thousands and thousands of years, and we have no answer to it. All you've done is put it in concrete coffins in the ground and hope it'll go away. Yeah, nuclear energy will never replace basic fossil fuel across the world, and it isn't doing. It's a very marginal thing. In France, where it's probably the got its greatest utility, of course, it's very intermittent and hit and miss. And because of the rising shortage of uranium, of course, which will get worse as demand in the world goes up with attempts to try and stop using coal, then France has started to develop coal power as well. So it's started to reopen its mines. The Germans, of course, opened 14 new coal power stations in the last couple of years. China builds a power station at least once every day, and hundreds of power stations, and coal production around the world is expanding. So, you know, you can use a crystal ball and say, yeah, let's have nuclear instead. Well, you ain't going to get there. It'll take you 20 years to develop a single new nuclear power station. And even then, as I say, they're very intermittent, and you only need one big disaster. If we have a disaster in the miners die. Usually, with the exception of Aberfan. If you have a disaster in a power station, everybody dies.
Looking at the bigger picture, because much of the entire landscape of energy has changed, we've now got really, I mean, ever since Margaret Thatcher got rid of exchange controls back in 1980, when she was first elected, we've now got a massive amount of foreign ownership of what used to be our infrastructure, because that was privatised too. And I'm pretty amazed to see that a lot of these decisions are being made by private equity firms, hedge funds, and obviously foreign people. Do you think is there a link here between Britain's energy policy being such a mess and actually it being something which is now controlled by foreigners?
The most important thing for Thatcher and her free market idea and her extreme monetarism policy was to transform Britain from an industrial producing country whose wealth depended on real things, making things, producing things, selling things, consuming things, our own things, in shipyards, heavy engineering plants, all the rest of it, the car industry, all of that, to move from that, because I believe of her terror. So she sort of read Karl Marx in reverse. Let the bourgeoisie tremble at the proletarian revolution. The proletariat is the industrial working class. If she could neuter the industrial working class and get rid of the mass regiments of the proletariat by closing the industries down, importing what you need, exporting the super exploitation of workers to the third world, where they had no unions or very ineffectual unions, and have your production done in China or Indochina or Timbuktu, literally, or wherever, then you can have your cake and eat it. And you can have you can create a second front, so that the class, the raw nature of the class war will take place abroad with people less able to fight it than we had. We were a stronger enemy than they are at the moment. It's a change, of course. I mean, even in Vietnam, there are mass strikes all of the time as people just, and in China, people won't work for the wages they used to work for before. So the idea was to make this a basically service consumption economy with very weak unions. I mean, you could tell the workers to go and seize McDonald's, but it's not actually got a your finger on the pulse of the jugular if you're taking over service places. You're not much inconvenience a few people like McDonald's. It's not the same as taking over a shipyard or a coal mine or a steelworks.
Does it come to you as a surprise that the Chinese have decided that they don't want to be? I think it's in Scunthorpe. The headlines say UK steel is on a knife edge after the Scunthorpe coking ovens have closed. Now, these are owned by China.
Yeah, I don't understand that, because if you're going to produce steel, new steel, you need coke. So if you close down your own coke works, you have to import that coke from somebody else's coking plant. There aren't any other than a steelworks. So either you import the coke from abroad and do this whole absolutely absurd exercise. I can't see the point. Because what is killing British Steel is the price of the steel. And that's because we're dependent, because there's been a policy of destroying steel. So steel has more than a third of its cost as tax. They pay a carbon tax of a third, which other countries don't have. So everything we produce, the steel, and everything made from our steel, is a third dearer at least than anybody else's. So it's driving the world's awash with cheap steel at the moment. It's driving British Steel out of existence over this whole net zero anti-carbon dogma.
But can you just explain what a coking oven is? This is in a steelworks, and is it a particular type of coal, or can it be any coal that's used?
Well, you need particular qualities of coal that are going to have the consistency to produce the coke. And what you do is you extract basically the gas and the other impurities out of the coal and leave a husk. It's a modern version of making charcoal. When
Rather
people,
than using wood, you're using coal.
yes. You're using coke because coke burns hotter than coal does.
Right, so coke is a different type of coal, is it?
No, you can burn coal on your fire just as coal. Or you can put it in a coke works and take the minerals out of it and burn it as coke.
Oh, right.
Applied to industry, steelworks in particular, it produces a higher temperature than coal does, and none of the impurities or the waste. Of very little of the waste, which is exactly the same process as when in the early Iron Age, people discovered that instead of just trying to smelt iron with wood, if you use charcoal, it burnt at a hotter temperature.
Right, I'm with you. Anyway, we've heard this week that the Friends of the Earth challenge to the Whitehaven coking mine, the new one in Cumbria, is not going to be allowed. Can you just tell us what's going on there? Whitehaven, the idea is to bring this kind of this, because you've just said to me you can put coal in a coking plant and you treat it and it can then be used to make steel.
Yeah.
Is this what kind of coal is this that they're bringing out of the ground?
You can do most things with coal, right? But some coal lends itself to different tasks, like steam coal that you would use in your vintage steam engines or in any of the heritage museums that still use coal. Most of them now use plastic bloody electric fires instead. Then that steam coal, it creates a greater volume. A temperature to create greater volumes of steam. Coking coal has less impurities to take out in the first place to make the coke, and the mine at Whitehaven is ideally suited for the coal needed for the creation of coke in steelworks. At the moment, the steelworks are operating using coal, of course, which is imported from Appalachia, which is the most destructive mining complex in the world. They have vast, they call it mountaintop removal, strip mining, where they just push the top off the mountain and expose huge hundreds of feet high coal seams, which they quarry. And then they walk away and leave it. There are no environmental controls there. And that's the coal that's currently coming in to Britain to be used in our steelworks. Now, Friends of the Earth have no objection to that coal being imported here, even though it produces more CO2, obviously, because it's put on vast trains miles long across the whole continent of America, and then shipped in super tankers across to Britain. And then it's transported to the steelworks that makes the coke. The emissions from the coke is exactly the same as what we're talking about at Whitehaven, except it carries more emissions due to the transport. Right? Friends of the Earth's case fell flat at the first instance when they had no objections to the current situation. And my quick, because I give evidence at all of the inquiries, I asked them, if we don't open this coal mine, how much emissions do we save? Well, none, of course. The emissions are the same. It's just instead of producing it here, we produce it somewhere else. There is classic virtue signaling.
This is a strategic industry, isn't it, steel? I'm surprised that this is left just to the vagaries of the market. If there's a water fight in Europe, which seems to be, we're having a few problems over in Eastern Europe, in Ukraine, Britain may not have steelworks to produce the equipment it needs to fight a war.
Absolutely. And the whole policy, both of all of the political parties, is actually to get rid of British Steel in terms of new steel and leave us as a Steptoe's junkyard of the world, where we'll recycle everybody else's steel. So 70% of the steel in the world is new steel. In Britain, 70% is recycled steel. But that steel is very limited. You don't need coal and coke to recycle steel, because it's already been made using coal and coke. But there's not enough steel in the world to recycle. That would either meet with demands, and certainly not the conditions you need to create high tension, flexible steel needed, for example, for hundreds of foot wind turbines, or for high rise flats, or for super bridges, or for any railway lines, or for anything of that kind. That needs new steel. Now, you cannot make it yourself. You can import it and pretend that somehow you're meeting the net zero target because somebody else is producing your emissions. Well, this is a kind of utter nonsense, which we've heard from Friends of the Earth right the way through the 7 years of objected to this mine.
So, what's the schedule with the mine? When is this coal likely to come on stream and start being used to make steel in Britain?
It'll take. Well, most of it now will go to Europe, for the Germans in particular to make steel to send here for us to use, because we're closing down our primary steelworks. There may be two left by the time it opens, in which case we'll be in the position to supply them. But whether you make the steel here or you make the steel in Germany, you need the coal to do it. So we're looking at a. Friends of the Earth are still saying they're going to appeal against the decision not to allow them to appeal. I mean, they've really run out of options other than going to Lourdes or lobbying the Pope, I think. So we'll go ahead. It'll take about 2 years before the mine is actually producing coal, while the infrastructure gets developed. And I hope to be there helping to develop that infrastructure and, of course, recreating the National Union of Mine Workers at that pit.
Right. You mentioned a book. Can you just remind us of the title and how people can get hold of it, David?
The coal climate change and the total destruction of the British mining industry is becoming a very rare book. You can get it from The Word, which is the major library in South Shields, and directly from me at Douglas with two S's, DouglasDavid705@gmail.com. It'll cost you 15 quid post paid.
Finally, there was an article in the Mail over the weekend about the revival of mining of lithium in Cornwall. Also, chatting down there to some of the ex-tin miners, They said that actually 1,000 years BC there was tin being mined down in Cornwall, and during the Thatcher era it was stopped. So what do you make of the Cornish industry in tin and lithium now?
Well, it's not just Cornwall, is it? We've actually got a piece of geology in the Durham area, which also bears lithium in Cleveland, Durham area. So we'll be developing both Cornwall and Durham for the production of lithium. Yeah, I mean, what the Friends of the Earth and people like that don't tell the Greens is there are no renewables, firstly, without coal. There are none. There are no renewables in the world that can do anything without the coal to produce them. You also need graphite, especially for solar panels. But you need rare earth metals, including lithium. And you need the production of rare earth metals for the magnets and for the structure inside the wind turbine. You also need an average wind turbine uses 700 gallon liters of oil a year to make it work. So, if you want to stop oil, you can't have a wind turbine. So all of these things, all of the renewables require mining, mineral mining, fossil fuel mining, and oil. So in theory, I have no objection whatever to the whole switching over to renewables. I mean, it won't work. You can't run a fuel economy based on wind. But because making the renewables necessitates mining of all descriptions.
But it seems to be sort of coming back into fashion, particularly to make, bizarrely, to make batteries for electric cars.
Yes. I mean, whether or not the batteries give off more emissions than the internal combustion engine is open to debate. The difference is marginal, really. The first 5 years of the production of an electric car using the batteries is probably worse than using petrol or diesel. But there you go. I mean, if you want to give yourself a warm glow inside and think you're doing something good, then that's what it's all been about, to be honest.
And if your batteries, after a couple of years, that what they're doing with the batteries is they're reducing the guarantees on them, so that maybe after a year or 18 months, your battery stops holding its charge, and you're going to have to pay £10,000 for a new one.
Yeah, and you can't recycle the old one in the same way that you can't recycle the giant turbine propellers. They all go into landfill.
Doesn't sound very green. Anyway, look, David Douglas, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.